welcome to episode 2 of the In Our House Now podcast. This is a inquiry into Twin Peaks The Return. I'm one of your co-hosts, Josh Minton. John Thorne is also with me, and we have a very special guest today, Jeff Lemire, author and graphic novelist, just phenomenal artist, and we're so happy for your time, Jeff. Welcome, and John, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Josh.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. It's honestly, I don't get to talk to anyone anymore. this is a nice reprieve to actually talk to someone else, but something other than COVID-19, you know.
We live in strange times. It's so true. And before we get into our topic of the day, which is going to be memories as a theme for Twin Peaks The Return, Jeff, I'd love to just hear a little bit about A, how you are, and then how is the industry that you work in?
Yeah, I mean, it's it's interesting times for sure. Personally, I'm okay. You know, as I was saying to you guys off before we started recording, my day-to-day life as a cartoonist and a writer hasn't really changed, you know, because I do everything all in isolation anyway. But, you know, it's I'm in Canada, so things are, I think, a little better here. The population's smaller and more spread out, so that works to our benefit a little bit in slowing it down. But so, you know, on a day-to-day personal level, I'm okay. But, you know, professionally, the comic book industry is like so many other industries and are really taking a hit. And it's, it's definitely uncertain, uncharted waters for the comic book industry and for comic book retailers, especially who can't be open during this time. It's going to be really hard for a lot of them to endure this and to come back. And then obviously the publishers I work for don't have an outlet to sell the books anymore. So it's scary, you know, for us and for everyone really, economically, but also just at a personal level. But, you know, I'm still working on all my projects or most of my projects. A couple have been, some of the smaller publishers have kind of put a halt work order down just to slow everything down because there's no way to print the books anymore or get them out. So they just kind of have to put a freeze on things. And then, you know, and then some of the other stuff is still business as usual, and we're just kind of stockpiling the work and getting ahead. So I still definitely have enough to keep me busy, but it's a lot of uncertainty for sure.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about just the local comic book stores, and I know I have a store I go to every Wednesday, and you know it's a ritual to go and socialize there and see the new books that come in every week, and it's a valuable experience. I'm not sure how many other people can relate to it, but for me, it's been all my life, and I certainly look forward to the day when we can do that again. And I hope that this does not severely impact those stores and that experience, because it was just, you know, it still is important.
I think a lot of comic book fans traditionally aren't the most sociable of people, you know? So I think the weekly ritual of going every Wednesday, new comic book day, to the shop and having other people, like-minded people to kind of interact with and talk about the new books. And I think it's a really special thing for a lot of people. You know, I know it always was for me. And then, you know, as a father, it's been really fun for me to now start taking my son to the comic store every Wednesday. And he's actually more excited about the new Star Wars comics or whatever than I am any these days. But that, you know, you find joy in that as well. So, yeah, hopefully we can all get through this and find a way back to it.
Yeah.
On that note, you know, what can we do as fans to help out and assist in this time? Are there any charities? Are there any events? I noticed that you're selling a piece of your own art.
Yeah, there's a thing actually today. Well, I'm not sure when you guys are going to put this podcast out, but it's right now it's Wednesday, and there's kind of an industry-wide thing today where creators for comics, where all kinds of comic book creators are auctioning off all kinds of stuff, artwork, signed books, you know, online writing workshops, all kinds of things. So if you go to that hashtag, it's going to run all week, and basically all the proceeds will go to indie bookstores and comic bookstores. So there's a lot of things like that popping up, and I feel like that's just the beginning of these kind of initiatives. They'll continue, you know, and try to give back to the retailers who provide us with a living. So we're doing what we can, yeah. And I'm actually just before I got on the podcast with you guys, I got a message from Damon Lindelof, another Twin Peaks super fan, saying he would match the high bidder on my Sweet Tooth artwork. He's gonna match whatever the high bid is, and obviously whoever bids will get the art, not Damon. But he's helping out too. So yeah, so there's things, you know, if you go online, there's a lot of, I know certain shops have GoFundMe things going. So if you do frequent a certain comic book store, wherever you are listening to this, you can kind of, there might be something where you can help the employees of that shop already set up, or, you know, if you go on my Twitter or the Twitter of other comic creators, I think you'll start to see all the links to different charities and whatnot.
I'm impressed by all the different tactics stores and artists are using, you know, to stay connected these days. At the local comic book store I go to, I'm going to give them a little plug, Keith's Comics in Dallas. They do a thing now on Facebook, a live thing called Old Comic Book Wednesday instead of New Comic Book. and he goes through his warehouse and pulls out old books and shows you what he's got. And then you can just say, hey, you know, I want to get that. And so there's some clever ways of staying connected to the fans and keeping us all involved in the hobby. Good work, Jeff, for doing all that you're doing. We really appreciate it out here in the hinterlands.
we all got to pitch in, you know? So, yeah.
It's true. Yeah, it's very true. Well, gentlemen, with that, why don't we get into today's topic? Obviously, we're all Twin Peaks fans, and we're here to talk about, you know, the return in particular. But we did have a theme around today, and I think Jeff was pretty excited to come in. I think, you know, you're working on some stuff that has similar themes in terms of memories. And John had some great quotes that he gathered that he'd like to kick us off with. So if you don't mind, John, can you get us started?
I sure can. Yeah. You know, memory is such a fascinating topic when it comes to Twin Peaks, but it's also just a fascinating topic when it comes to David Lynch. And Lynch has commented both in his work and outside his work on how memory works for him. I think the most famous memory quote from a Lynch work is from Lost Highway. And that's when Fred Madison says, I like to remember things the way I remember them, not necessarily the way they happened. And I think that's, you know, it's interesting to look at that and think about that. And I have highlighted a couple of other, I'll read them very quickly, Lynch quotes about memory. This is from Lynch on Lynch. And he's talking about memory when he was a child. And he says, an accurate memory of the past would be depressing, probably. So that was one comment that was interesting about how he views memory. And then this is from his new book, Room to Dream, where he's talking about memory. And he says, I think people's memories are different. Sometimes their memories are flat out wrong, but mostly they're just different. And so I think what Lynch is getting at in Lost Highway and then in those quotes I just read is the idea that we remember things, the parts of them that maybe we fondly remember stand out, and we kind of suppress maybe some of the ones, memories that we don't necessarily care for. And everybody kind of sees things their own way, and so everyone has a different perspective. I mean, obviously, it's just a broad topic, and Lynch doesn't get into too much detail, but you can see he's thought about it. And I think that theme of memory is certainly something that is important when we look at not only how we approach the new Twin Peaks, Twin Peaks The Return, but also how that theme is working its way in the narrative as well.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know about you guys, but I kind of get the sense that quote, the Lost Highway quote, what was it? What's the exact quote, John? Just so I don't mess it up. Yeah, and I wonder if I've often thought about that in terms of just the way that he and Frost worked on when they were writing the new Twin Peaks, and I, obviously we have no way of knowing this or whatever, but it all, I almost get the sense that they picked and chose parts of the canon or the continuity that were important to them, you know, and played a little looser with other things. You saw it in Frost's book, you know, the first one, where certain things didn't quite line up with what we knew from the original Twin Peaks, and just the way they play with the mythology. It's almost like they chose to remember some of it the way they wanted to shape the new narrative, rather than, I wish I could think of a specific, you know, example right now, but it does seem like, I remember some quotes from Frost too, when he was promoting the book, saying, you know, it's their canon. They'll kind of, it's malleable to how they want it to be for the new narrative, you know? And so I think even their memories of what Twin Peaks was, and I know Lynch has famously said for him, Twin Peaks is the pilot and Fire Walk With Me, you know? And even though he was pretty heavily involved with a lot of the rest of the stuff, I think he, maybe it didn't hold the same importance to him, you know, 30 years later in his memory. And he kind of just latched onto that last episode and the first one almost.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, especially when it comes to Lynch. I think Lynch, his memory of Twin Peaks is less the day, week-to-week series, but the projects that he had to go on location to shoot, and he viewed them as films. So the pilot certainly was a big project that they went. They all traveled up to Snoqualmie Falls in Washington State, and they filmed this pilot. And in his mind, it was essentially filming a feature film. And he did the same with Fire Walk With Me. They traveled up there and did a lot of the work up there on location. I think those kind of experiences stick out in his mind. I'm not trying to make an excuse for him. I know there's a lot of people who are kind of angry that he made that comment. But the series was just, I think he got in his car and drove down the street and shot in a warehouse or, you know, in the studio. And it didn't make the impact on him as the experience of those other works. And so that's I guess, how I interpret why he says that about the pilot and Fire Walk With Me. There's something, as he says, an accurate memory of the past might be depressing, and he is remembering those things that he was enthused about when he was making Twin Peaks.
Yeah, and was still excited about 30 years later, the things that inspired him to go back, you know? So
Yes.
And that's what, kind of how it should be, you know? You kind of latch on to the things that still excite you creatively. And if some of the other details don't quite fit with what you want to do now, I understand that as a creator of kind of, you know, just not giving them as much importance. And especially with Lynch, he seems like someone who's so intuitive and in the moment and in creating, that if something is exciting him and he wants to do it, he's not going to let, you know, continuity or details from the original series stop him from doing it.
Well, I think we've all probably experienced this in our lives, as we've come across people from our past, and, you know, we've obviously changed a lot in the interim, and so have they, but yet, you know, we're not expected to remember every single thing we said to them and every experience that we shared together 25 years ago. And I think it's the same with creative works as well. You know, John, your point about those experiences that you have, especially, you know, having traveled to Snoqualmie, I can remember the first time I went there, just, you know, walking around the basin of the falls and just the sheer magnitude of that power that comes down there. And then you have all these signs around there talking about the electricity that they generate. Of course, electricity became part of the mythology there, you know, and of course it stayed that way throughout the entire series, you know, all three and the film. It's just, it's something that doesn't go away, right?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, when all your senses are kind of sparked like that, no pun intended, you know, you experience nature and a new place, it makes an impression, and that memory is stronger than other memories. Again, I sound like I'm making an excuse for Lynch, but I think I'm just trying to explain why he sees things. And then getting to Jeff's point about creativity, I think both Lynch and Frost had an enthusiasm for certain aspects of the work that they produced. And they wanted, you know, they had this energy to go back into that and explore it. And I don't think they wanted to be bounded by the accuracy of the past necessarily. They wanted to go with what motivated them and what invigorated them about what they had done. And maybe it was a wise idea on their part not to be so slavishly devoted to the minutiae of the narrative of what happened in episode 19 of season 2 or whatever, but to look at it more broadly and what was it, it got them together in the first place, and how did they want to re-explore, re-examine that? I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, Jeff, but was that kind of maybe what you were thinking?
Yeah, no, that is exactly it. Yeah, I know for myself, I wish I could say what it is, but I'm actually going back to an old book of mine right now and doing a return to it, you know, a decade after I finished something. And I'm doing the same thing where there are things about that project that I remember and that I kind of a decade later sort of associate with it. And those are the things that I've latched onto and am, you know, building the new world around. I haven't gone back and reread the whole book or anything. And I don't really care that, you know, much about the details of issue by issue what I had done back then. It just, so I can kind of get that. You just get excited and you want to do something new. And I think that's for them, that was what, where they were probably coming from, you know, they each, and I think the interesting thing there is probably the different things that excited them each, you know, Mark Frost and David Lynch were probably excited by different things from one another. And there was probably a push and pull there, which is always seems to be when they get their best work as a duo.
Yeah. You know, that interplay between the two of them over Skype is something that's fascinated me ever since I first found out about it. Man, well, and there is an article out there. I guess Frost spoke at a writer's convention shortly after the season 3 aired, and basically he described a period in which they wrote nothing down. They just had these interactions and conversations, and he describes, you know, explaining narratively what could happen in a scene, and then David would like close his eyes, or he said he got a look on his face that you could just tell he was seeing it in his head. And I'm thinking, like, that is like Lennon and McCartney coming together and putting a melody to a rhythm, and it's such a beautiful image. And I love that they come from different perspectives. You know, Frost actually made a comment that he's a Jungian, so he thinks of things in terms of Carl Jung and like walking through your shadow self, and David Lynch could care less about the psychology, you know, of it all. And I think that's it. That's just like, that's where they came from. So I'd love to just kind of touch on our former theme of baggage and, you know, thinking of memory as baggage. You know, what did you come in, Jeff, when you first saw The Return? What baggage did you bring in terms of memory?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting, you know, the things before The Return started, the things that you kind of, all of us probably had different, like a little checklist of things we hoped to see, you know, you know, for me, I definitely wanted to see Cooper get out of the Black Lodge, because seeing him sort of stranded there at the end of season 2 was so devastating when that happened. You know, I still remember, you know, watching that for the first time, and I was traumatized for days after that. I had invested so much in that character, and I was probably, I don't know how old I was when I saw the, because I remember watching the show as it first aired on ABC, but not all of it. I was, I think, only 13 or 14. And it really started to freak me out, the Bob stuff, at some point where I kind of had to stop. And then I found it on VHS maybe 3 or 4 years later and watched the whole thing through over like 2 days. And I was so invested in Cooper and just loved that character like everyone else so much. To see him sort of corrupted, or what seemed like he was corrupted at the end, I remember being really shaken. I remember being in high school and the next day going to school and just walking around like a shell. I just couldn't believe poor Cooper was trapped, you know? So, I mean, for me, the thing I went into the new one the most was just really wanting to see him find some way out. And, you know, other than that, he was always the central sort of figure for me. So this stuff, I had little things I'd like to see. You know, I wanted to see Harry and Coop together again, and I wanted to see Audrey and things like that. But the big one was really his journey out, which I guess The Return kind of was, but not of course, in any way that any of us could have ever guessed or projected, you know. So I don't know if that has a lot to do with memory, Josh, but that's just sort of my gut reaction to that question.
Really, that's what a lot of us went into season three. You can't help if you're a fan before, and I think most people who watched it probably were. There may be a few who weren't, who hadn't seen the earlier series, but obviously it was that devastating cliffhanger that had been hanging over our heads for 25 years. And I think Lynch and Frost at least knew that they had to explore that. I don't think we expected them to take so long, but that was maybe the driving energy of the new season was Cooper's in this predicament. What does it mean? Not necessarily how does he get out, but what does it mean? And then they explored it from there. But I said this on the earlier podcast. For me, that was the baggage I guess I brought. Other than that, I tried to remain as open to whatever they were going to do, and let them play with it. As Jeff said, we had read Frost's book, which somewhat was another piece of baggage we were bringing with us, because we were oriented in a way to expect maybe certain things to connect with that book, and not only with the old show but with that book. And I didn't see a lot of connection to the book as the show went along, and that was something I'm just remembering that now. Isn't that funny? That I was somewhat trying to reconcile and struggle with. I'd go back to the book in the middle of the show and go, wait a minute, I'm not sure what's happening here. So anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when Wally Brando mentioned Lewis and Clark in his little monologue there, and I'm like, oh, okay, finally we're getting into this stuff, because I found that really fascinating in Mark's book. And of course, it meant nothing.
Yeah. I think maybe the biggest connection between the book and the return ended up being maybe the characterization of Major Briggs as a kind of filling in this backstory for him that was only hinted at in the original show. Mark certainly fills it in a lot by making him the archivist and everything else, and then they kind of pick up on that, in the show with his kind of importance in the narrative. It's funny, actually, just thinking about that now, when we think about memory, one of the strongest kind of ways that theme plays out in the show, I think, is with Briggs and with Bobby, especially. I feel like these memories of, remember, like Bobby remembering him and Briggs when he was a kid taking him to Jack Rabbit's Palace, and they kind of build so much stuff in to Bobby and Briggs that wasn't really in the original show, but it feels so natural the way they do it. And even, when you guys mentioned memory as, I'm just going on tangents a little bit now, but when you mentioned memory as the theme for this show, I don't know for you two, but when you said that, what was the first scene you thought of when we thought of memory and season three? Because for me, it was the moment when Bobby walks into Sheriff's office and sees the picture of Laura and reacts to it, starts crying. I don't know if it's episode 3 or 4 or whatever. And that always struck me as a bit funny. And I think something about that scene, it had sort of a weight to it that I always wondered if there was more there than was on the surface. And I think that's where Mark Frost's book started to mess with me a little bit, where there were I am sure you guys remember, before the show came out and we were all reading the book, there were those discrepancies with sort of the continuity of the show, and we thought they all meant something maybe more than they did, like there was some kind of alternate timeline at work or whatnot. And then with that in mind, when I saw that scene, I always felt like the way Bobby reacts to that, it's almost like he had forgotten Laura and he's remembering her, a little bit. And I don't know, it always struck me as something like when Cooper goes back at the end and changes things, were we seeing some of the world after that, and were we seeing a world where they had forgotten that Laura died and he was remembering in that moment? And I'm probably overthinking all that stuff, but something about that scene always kind of comes back to me.
It is a powerful scene, and I don't think you're overthinking it. you asked what was the first thought I might have had when we were talking about memory. There was a lot of references to memory and remembering throughout the 18 hours. One of the most curious, it for me, is where Cole describes to Albert the dream, and he remembers Philip Jeffries having come to visit them. And Albert looks at him and he says, "I'm beginning to remember that too," as if the memory had been erased. And what you describe about Bobby is really interesting, because you could almost argue that Bobby was triggered into this set of memories that he hadn't necessarily suppressed, but that he had forgotten, which is hard to imagine. But there's something going on with many of the characters, as if they're existing in this sort of shadow world where they can't quite connect to the past, and then they do or they don't, and they're struggling with their place in this flow of time. And there's things at work there. I don't know if I can, you know, clearly, you know, decipher them, but they do work in ways, just like you said with the Bobby scene, Jeff, where it's a very powerful thing.
Yeah, and even the Lucy stuff, where she kind of, her thing with technology, where she almost is stuck in time, and then you know, when she shoots Bag Cooper at the end, it's almost like everything catches up to her, and you know, that's a little bit different, but it's a similar thing. And then the big line too is when Coop goes to near the end, when he goes to go back in time, and he talks to the Philip Jeffries machine, and he says Cole will remember the official version, you know, that whole line. I feel like a lot of those things kind of link back to that scene with Albert and Cole, especially, and maybe the Bobby stuff. And there is something weird going on with triggered memories and suppressed memories there, I think, you know. And with all things Twin Peaks, the more you look at it, the less it starts to, sometimes the less it starts to connect together, you know.
That's true.
It falls apart on you, but there's, yeah, I always felt there was something going on there.
Yeah, and I love that Bobby scene you're describing is one of the few places where we actually get music in season three. There's, you know, I think that matters. It really does matter. It's almost like the full scope of the memory is allowed to come upon us, even as the viewer at that moment. I think music is really interesting in how it's not used in the return.
That's a fascinating comment, Josh. I never really thought about that, because, you know, there's a lot of studies that have been done about how music triggers memory, and music can bring back a memory that you might have totally forgotten. And I hadn't thought about this until just now, but there is less music, for lack of a better phrase, in The Return than there was, I think, in the original series. And I wonder if that was deliberate. You know, that those music cues would bring back memories, and so they deliberately chose not to use them. I don't know, just again thinking out loud.
Well, I guess what are some of the other moments? I guess when Cooper wakes up and the Mitchum brothers are getting the jet ready, there's a moment in that scene, and it's on the Mitchum brothers, where the music starts to cue. I remember thinking that's a really curious place to begin the theme of Twin Peaks. But it's interesting, you know, when you think about that.
Yeah. And getting back real quick to something Jeff just mentioned about Philip Jeffries, Jeffries says, Cole, remember the official version, but I think Jeffries also tells Cooper to remember. He directs him to, remember. And that also happens at the very, very beginning of the show when the fireman tells Cooper to remember. He gives him some instructions, as if he's saying, remember these instructions. But there's a parallel there. There seems to be, you know, people or beings who are trying to get Cooper to remember. And maybe that's one of Cooper's flaws or, you know, difficulties, is that his memory is not reliable. I mean, again, I'm thinking out loud here, which I guess is the whole purpose of this podcast. But but there are these fascinating occurrences of the word memory and remember throughout the 18 hours. And certainly you have Jeffries and the fireman both instructing Cooper to remember. And I don't think that's coincidental.
No, I don't think so either. And even when Coop does wake up and in the hospital room and whichever episode 15 or whatever it was, he does. It's, I always found it funny. He seems to remember everything that happened to him while he was Dougie, even though, you know, he wasn't, you know, that maybe a bit too, something with memory there where he's like instructing the one armed man to construct the Dougie Talpa. And he certainly seems like he was aware of everything that happened to him and remembers it all, you know, even though watching Dougie over those first 15 episodes, you wouldn't think he was there at all, you know? So Cooper must have been there watching and remembering a little bit.
Well, and remember when he tells Bushnell, he's like, give me the gun you keep in your holster on the side. Like, that's something that even as viewers, we didn't know. So it was like he had a superhuman, you know, sense.
I have a whole different theory about that, but we'll save that for another time.
I actually have a theory on that too, John. But I think I've read two books recently. I read the Twin Peaks Unwrapped book, and I read the Mark Frost book. I can't remember which one of those two books it was in, but Kyle MacLachlan, we're really getting off topic, but MacLachlan made some comment that in the original script, or even they may have filmed things where when he spoke to the one-armed man as Dougie, he was a little bit more cognizant and he was a little more Cooper than Dougie. So I think there were some scenes there where he came out of the Dougie-ness a bit more to have, you know, yeah. I don't know if that's what you were alluding to, but I think there was some stuff there that Lynch took out.
Yes, I think that's in the Twin Peaks Unwrapped book. I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure it is. And yes, we risk going way, way off topic here, but there is some curious things that happen in part 16 and part 17, which it seems very exaggerated. It seems very artificial that Cooper suddenly embodies, an aspect of himself that's idealized. And so I wonder how much of that is really happening and how much of that is his wishful thinking. But we can talk about that perhaps another time, but I think, yeah, I mean, all of it connects and all of it has to do with your mental state, I think, in terms of what you're perceiving. And memory is certainly something we carry with us all the time. And how are we perceiving our memories? It's a crucial element of the return.
When I like, you know, I think we've firmly established that memory can be a source of power, you know, for the characters in season three or the return, but it can also be a weapon. And I'm thinking specifically of the prison scene where Mr. C and Diane are engaging with one another. And Mr. C says, "Do you remember that night?" And, you know, this weight just falls on the scene and it's a brutal moment. And you know, they never showed us anything that happened between those two, but the violence is there, you know, the damage is there as well. And I'm wondering if you guys can think of any other places where memory is actually a weapon.
That's interesting. Yeah, that was the one scene. I was thinking of that too when we were speaking earlier, that scene with Diane, for sure. I don't know. Yeah, I'm trying to think of some more. Trying to think of some of the other storylines other than the Cooper stuff, but...
I feel like Hastings, William Hastings, remembering, you know, what happened. That's just a brutal, you know, scene to watch as well.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah.
Hey, that's interesting that you bring up Bill Hastings, too, because like what we were talking about with Albert and Cole, where they both said, I'm beginning to remember that, you get a sense that Hastings doesn't really know. I mean, it's almost, you know, you feel that he's reliable when he says, I don't remember, or I don't know what happened, but then it starts to leak back into his mind. You get a sense that it's starting to manifest, and he's reacting to it. I mean, he kind of crumbles as the series goes along into this, you know, he's just kind of weak and crying and lost. And I think the weight of the memories of his experience in the zone and the death of Ruth Davenport and just that his life is being pulled apart, they start to take root in his mind and it just devastates him. So, he seems to have suppressed it, or it isn't in his mind at all at the beginning. And then it kind of grows as time goes by.
That scene, and also the scene we spoke about earlier with Albert and Cole remembering Philip Jeffries from Fire Walk With Me. Some of that too, you almost get the feeling they're almost remembering something that it's almost like they dreamt it rather than lived it. And they're remembering a dream, you know, like in the way that you'll remember something you dreamed a year ago at some weird point. And it almost comes back to them like that rather than an actual memory, you know.
Hastings literally had his head exploded. And I just recently rewatched the show again, you know, we never actually see the woodsman blowing up Hastings' head. Like it's assumed, but you know, that idea of the woodsman placing his hand on someone's head and squeezing until they literally, you know, are bursting. That to me, what better metaphor can you have for memory as a weapon? It's just a really interesting metaphor to describe the memories that can undo us.
Yeah, it's interesting.
That's fascinating. It is because as Lynch has said in some of those quotes about people remember things differently, or an accurate memory would actually be pretty depressing. You certainly could pursue that, you know, idea and theme in the show about it's better perhaps just to live in the world you want to remember than the way it may really have happened. It's just better for your own psychological well-being.
Going back a little bit to the John, what you're saying about part, I think it's part 17, when everyone comes together at the sheriff's office and it feels a little artificial and over the top and strange, you know, and you almost wonder if those are, it's like this embodiment of the way Cooper remembers Twin Peaks and himself in Twin Peaks. And it's almost a cartoonish version of maybe what, you know, what really happened. And you almost feel like that scene or that sequence is maybe constructed through his dreams or memories rather than reality. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of how I'm looking at it now. And it is interesting how many, this gets a little off the topic of memory, but it kind of connected, is how many of the characters from the old show are stuck in place as if they haven't progressed at all through time. You have Shelley, still a waitress at the Double R. You have Ben sitting behind his desk. He never leaves that office in the show. There are production reasons for that, of course, but story-wise, he's there. Norm is always at that booth. She never leaves the diner. And if you want to look at it as if it's Cooper's version of events, it's almost as if he can't think of them any other way, that's how he remembers them. And so that's where they're going to be. And you get some evidence of that from Lucy, of all people. I mean, Lucy seems to sort of tap into the underlying structure of the story, where she talks about things like, what happens if we're not here? Is the thermostat really on? And the clock stopped, you know, once, and we didn't even know if time was happening, or were we, you know, it seemed like forever. And it kind of speaks to the idea that they are being influenced maybe by someone else's memory. It gets a little metaphysical, I know, but there are some odd things that are happening in that respect. And it is curious to me how much of the world of Twin Peaks, the town, seemed to be stagnant, that it didn't really progress in 25 years.
Yeah, for sure. Everyone seems stuck. Yeah.
Well, and wasn't that seen as a herald of the nostalgia for the original Twin Peaks, that it was a place that was kind of stuck in the 50s, you know, and now that it's stuck in the 90s, when we come back in there, where, you know, I guess Lucy's inability to grasp cellular phone technology, to me, I always kind of placed it in, hey, if Cooper's dreaming this and he was in a, you know, coma or whatever since 1989 or 91, of course he wouldn't know what cell phones are. But you know, I think your nuanced view there, John, is probably a little more accurate.
Well, I mean, I who knows, right? But it certainly gets you thinking about maybe there's some schemata at work that Lynch and Frost were both, you know, kind of hinting at. That, I mean, when you watch it, it clearly isn't, you know, pure reality. There are a lot of things that are inexplicable. And I think Lynch, if you look at all of his work from Eraserhead on, Lynch is more concerned with the internal struggle of a character than any kind of external struggle. So if there's a bad guy, that doesn't interest Lynch as much as how is the character in his or her own way of progressing. And so I think that that element is in place in The Return. And just the question is, you know, where is it in place? How much is it in place? And since it is really Cooper's story, you kind of have to think about it through Cooper's mind.
Yes, totally. This is a little off topic, but when we think about that, it all being through Cooper's mind and his memories of these people, and he can't imagine them having progressed, you know, you have to wonder where Freddy comes in, the green glove Freddy, and it's so out of nowhere. It's so out of nowhere in the narrative, and if you think of it from Cooper's POV, why would he create this character that's so separate from himself to defeat Bob, you know? And it always stuck out as something that was a bit out there when I watched it, and it still does.
Jeff, I'd actually love to dig in on this with you, because I would say that that's probably the most cartoonish or comic bookish part of The Return. And so
yes, it really is.
Really interested in your opinion on this.
And not in a good way. Yeah, it's such a superhero origin story. Literally, you know, Freddy's story is a superhero origin story. It's like a Marvel Comics thing of this all-powerful glove that this guy can't take off, and then he just happens to save the day of this young kid who's like a Peter Parker almost, you know. And you do have to wonder who that came from, Lynch or from Frost, you know. I would always presumed it was Frost, maybe wrongly, but I remember reading something with that actor who plays Freddy, how it was really Lynch who found him and who loved his British accent, and so I wonder if it did come from Lynch. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like I also remember Sabrina Sutherland saying that he had a box full of ideas they were going through, and one of them was this green glove that he just loved. So maybe it was just something, some half-formed idea for something he had at one time, and he just kind of threw it all in there. I don't know.
I think, you know, you could almost look at either Lynch or Frost, or obviously both of them, as kind of coming up with the idea. Frost was a big Marvel Comics fan in the 60s.
Yeah,
and of course he wrote the Fantastic Four movies, but he's talked about it, and he talks about it in the new David Buschman book, and at times we interviewed him long ago about how much influence Marvel Comics had on him. And I think both Lynch and Frost were pulling, you know, from their interests and from the things that inspired them. And you're absolutely right, Jeff. I mean, it really, that character is, I mean, he's like Hulk hands, you know, those toys you can buy, and he has a destiny.
Well, and that was the same episode that we saw Andy kind of ascend to the fireman's den as well. So we had just seen that scene play out. And so when Freddy comes in to tell about his origin story, we're like, yeah, of course, we just saw that happen.
Yeah. Yes, that was carefully put together that way. So we had seen Andy and the fireman, and then when we see Freddy talk about it, it's easier to envision.
Well, and then Andy's superpower would be that he'd been given very strict instructions and he followed them, which is, you know, probably not Andy's strong suit in his normal everyday life. But I think he did it to the letter, and that was it all worked very well, you know, in the end. But the green glove was interesting. I mean, I guess I try to put myself in the mind of someone who's dealing with an extreme negative force that's invaded my psyche, and I would have to create something to combat that. And is it really more ridiculous than the idea of an extreme negative force invading your psyche? I don't know.
Yeah, probably not. You know, maybe you can look at it as just this invention of Cooper's imagination, like an antibody to to battle this invading, you know.
If you don't mind, just, you know, getting back to the memory theme, it's curious, don't you think, in all of the 18 hours, how much is forgotten? And I say that, like, there are there are things that happen in the story and the characters seem to forget them. I don't know if it's the characters do or whether or not Lynch and Frost have decided, you know, we just kind of wanted to give you a little slice of something and move on. But a couple of examples. Andy's pursuing the hit and run accident, and he goes and he talks to this farmer guy, and the guy says, "I'll meet you up on the road," and Andy goes there, and that's never followed up again. It's as if Andy's almost forgotten it.
You know, just to stop you, John, I almost brought that scene up three times over this. There is something very strange about that scene. Also, going back to what we said earlier, that's one of the few times Lynch uses Laura's theme there as well, when Andy's waiting and he looks at his watch and he's waiting for the guy to meet him. To go back to memory and music, it's one of the few times he uses some of the music from that episode. And
that's interesting. I got to go back and look at that. Fascinating scene is when Bobby encounters the woman in the intersection, and it's a very traumatic, energetic scene of dismay, and the girl throwing up, and Bobby is, you know, kind of just stunned by what's happening. And then that's never referenced again. Now, there are a lot of reasons why it might not be, and that scene might be a reflection of Bobby's own psyche in the moment because he's just been through this thing with his daughter. I tend to think there's something going on like that there. But just in terms of surface narrative, I think it's noticeable that these things happen and then the characters seem to just move on as if it never happened. And I don't know if it has to do with memory or whether it's more of a structural approach that Lynch and Frost are taking to the story. But it certainly the first time I watched it, certainly, you know, you expected these things to be addressed again, and they weren't.
No, I think you're absolutely right, John. Yeah, and some of the stuff in the Roadhouse too, where you just have these, it kind of falls in line with some of those scenes where they were these plot lines or characters that were mentioned or introduced that we never go back to, and there are things like that, like you said, out beyond the Roadhouse as well, these plot lines that would start and never really no one would return to them or no one would reference them, or, you know, the whole sparkle thing was, it seemed like they were setting something up there with the sheriff's department sort of making a move to stop just the drug influx in Twin Peaks and everything. And it just kind of stops about halfway through the series and isn't referenced again, you know? And again, that might just be the approach they took, or it could be something else.
But, you know, that's a great example of memory, because it's an echo of the old Twin Peaks. I mean, the old Twin Peaks, the story was the Renault brothers were, you know, bringing drugs down from Canada, and the sheriff's department was, you know, trying to stop them. And that's exactly what happens when Truman talks to Bobby and he says, "Hey, you know, we think they're coming in from Canada." And it's the exact same plot again, which...
Well, all the bad things come from Canada.
There's that echo. And again, we could assign that to Cooper, who's just saying, "Okay, well, I'm back in Twin Peaks, and this is what was happening then, so it must be happening still or again." There's an interesting narrative approach from Lynch and Frost. It's sort of like a reminder of what it was for us. It brings back that memory, and yet on some level, perhaps they're saying, "But that's not really important. That's superficial plot. That's, you know, causality. A happens, B happens, C happens. You've seen all that a million times. We could do it again, or we could just acknowledge it and say, this is kind of a different story that's couched in those old templates." And I find that really intriguing, and it's sort of a new kind of narrative that they're doing. And it endlessly fascinates me.
It really is. Yeah. Like, no one has ever done anything like that on television before, where you just sort of take these tropes or these sort of, these storytelling kind of devices that we're all familiar with, and you couch it in that, but you introduce things and never fully explore them. You would never be allowed to do that. Having written a little bit for television now, the thought of trying to do something like that, it would just be so shot down in a writer's room or by producers or by the networks. You know, it's only Lynch with his kind of carte blanche that he had could do it, but it is fascinating. It's like a whole new paradigm of storytelling where you develop this world that exists, but you don't necessarily explore all these things you introduce. You just kind of explore the things that are important to you. And yeah, it's interesting. The whole shape of the show is so unique.
Yes. Oh, without doubt. Yeah, it is.
It puts me in the frame of mind of the Bob Dylan song Desolation Row, where he'll just throw out these little phrases of characterization. You're like, that could be a whole novel. Just that one little short phrase is its own short story. And in each of those dramas, like in The Roadhouse, for example, could have been their own show in some cases.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
like tricks nonsense that, you know, that happened to him. That whole thing was fascinating, but then it was never talked about again.
You know, speaking of memories in The Roadhouse, one thing that just came up, Josh, was in my mind, was the whole Audrey storyline. And it's almost like her, when she does get to the Roadhouse and she does her dance, it's almost that memory of who she was and of Audrey's dance and everything that wakes her up as well. And almost like you said, memory as a weapon or as a tool there. It's only when she gets out of the house that she's in, whether it's literal or not, with Charlie, and gets to the row house and remembers her dance, that things sort of happen for her too.
I think that's an excellent example of memory. I mean, that sort of encapsulates it right there. I mean, Audrey, whether or not it's really happening or not, and I would think it probably is not, quote unquote, really happening, but Audrey finds herself in a space that is the Roadhouse, and when she is there, she experiences a vivid memory again. That memory of that music and that dance, certainly a callback to the old show.
Music bringing back memories too, again.
Exactly, and it is, as we've explored here, it's almost as if the memories are triggering thing. It comes back, and it causes some significant change in the character. Something shifts.
Yeah. It's like Josh said, it's either a weapon or a key, you know, depending who it is or which character it is.
Well, that's great. The key itself is a manifestation of a memory. The key to the Great Northern has Cooper's phrase on the back, which of course it would not be there. And so it's like a physical memory, you know, memory became an actual artifact. And so, yeah.
Well, doesn't it feel like the Log Lady's comment about it all comes flowing back now like that? It's memory. I really do feel like it's a suppression of memory. It's a suppression of reality. You know, I feel like that's Bob's power, is that he can literally manipulate the reality of who's dreaming. And we saw this with Laura's story, right?
And we saw it with Leland too, where he really, there was always that question of how much Leland was aware of what he was doing, how much he remembered. And then in the, you know, that great episode when Leland dies and Bob says something like, when I leave him, watch the, you know, pull the ripcord and watch it all come flooding back. And he remembers it, you know? And so there is something with Bob and memory, I think, for sure, Josh. Well, we cracked it, guys. We just solved Twin Peaks.
We can go home now. Do you think that'll ever happen, by the way? Do you think we'll ever put down Twin Peaks?
No, no, no. I don't think it is solvable.
No, of course not. Yeah, that's what's so great about it. I feel like there's more to memory in this show than I feel like we could do another one if we all watch the show and find so many more things that are in there that we aren't thinking about at the moment, but it's I think one of the key, maybe the key theme of the whole show really could be memory and nostalgia and remembering who we thought we were or we want to be as opposed to who we really are, you know, like could be something there. I think that's a big part of the whole thing.